In the last few weeks, protesters have taken to the streets to campaign against racial inequality.
All lives matter. Black, white, all lives matter.
We're all human beings. There should be fairness for all of us, which means that black lives matter.
Whatever your view on the social and political implications of the protests, the message is resonating widely and has therefore dredged up a thorny subject for the investment world.
The role of the CEO and the role of the corporation has changed.
How much does good social practice matter to companies? And to what extent are those companies accountable for social malpractice?
The importance of good social image for one company in particular is something that we will be discussing with Philip Ryland in this podcast. And we'll also be talking to Phil Oakley later on about investment matters.
And I have spoken to James Norrington about how all this ties in to one especially hot investment topic, ESG. I'm Megan Boxall.
And I'm John Heumann. Welcome to the Investment Hour. So Megan, it seems kind of strange to be talking about social justice and protest movements in the context of an investment podcast. I mean, what's going on and why does it matter?
Yeah, I mean, this was actually something that was brought up in a news meeting a couple of weeks ago. We were sort of debating whether or not we could touch on the Black Lives Matter protests and what's been happening worldwide in response to the death of George Floyd in America. And it's difficult, obviously, to make the link between an incredibly important cause and investment, which is also very important, but they do seem like very, very different things. But there is definitely a link between the two things. And at the same time as these protests have been happening, SoftBank actually released a racial inequality fund, or a fund that is set up to combat racial inequality. And that was how we started talking about this. And that's actually something that I will talk to James Norrington about later. But actually, it did get us thinking about the role of social equality in general, not just in terms of race, but gender equality and all sorts of different things. And that's a really important part of managing business. And it's something that is, I mean, it's the S of ESG, the social side of ESG. And it is very important because it can help, and it's been proven to help, make businesses run better.
What evidence is there that that is the case?
It's anecdotal to a certain extent. If you follow ESG funds, there are all sorts of comparisons between share price movement and good ESG scores. I tend to take them with a little bit of a pinch of salt because ESG scores are random, seemingly. People try to be completely accurate, but I mean, especially the social side, it relies so much on company self-reporting. We're doing this, we're doing that. Is it really good social practice that they're doing, or are they just saying they're doing it? And that's the problem I have with ESG scoring. But it's just common sense. Looking at companies which are performing well from a social point of view, and I mean, one really interesting one is Diageo, which arguably isn't a particularly socially moral company. It makes alcohol. Others would say that's very moral, but not everyone. But they
score, I would.
So would I. They score extremely highly on social equality metrics because they have the same amount of women on their board as they do men. They have a very diverse range of people who work in senior management. They support their more junior staff very nicely, and they always come up really, really well on nice place to work and things like that. And Diageo is a fantastic company. It's extremely well run. It's extremely successful. It's one of the UK's best companies. And you can see that across many, many different sectors as well. Wetherspoons is one that repeatedly comes up for the sometimes slightly questionable turns of phrase of its chief executive. But its staff are rewarded for good performance. And that's a great way of running a company. And maybe that falls slightly more into governance than it does the social aspect. But they're given good opportunities at Wetherspoons. There's an excellent shareholder scheme, employee shareholder scheme. And Wetherspoons is an extremely well-run and an extremely well-performing pub company.
I mean, it's quite interesting that you mentioned governance. I'd like to come on to that, the G in ESG. I mean, it sounds like for Diageo to have got to the position where it is would have taken many, many, many years, long before this became fashionable. But we're now seeing lots of companies trying to retrofit the S onto their businesses. I mean, is this just wishful thinking on their part? Are they trying to change too much, too fast? And in some respects, potentially damaging their businesses.
And for what reason are they doing it as well? That's the thing I think. Are people doing it just so they can match the ESG scores? Are they doing it just so they can spin a good message? Because that's the wrong reason for good social practice. And that's something that I've talked about with both Philip and with James in the context of Nike, which is an extremely successful company. It's doing a lot for racial equality. It supports a lot of black athletes and uses those in their social media campaigns. But is that the right way of doing good social, a good social practice? Because it's also been called up for using sweatshops. So
does it still use sweatshops? I don't know. I know over the years a lot of consumer goods companies have obviously transferred a lot of manufacturing to the Far East. I'd imagine there's still quite a lot of labour that's used out there, and it's not the most highly paid labour, and I can't imagine the conditions are always brilliant. So there does seem to be a bit of a gulf between what companies say they would like to be and what they actually are if you dig beneath the surface.
And what they do on the surface, what they sort of using flashy names and saying we're doing all this wonderful stuff, is it actually the same in practice? And Wetherspoons is an extremely interesting example of that, as is Sports Direct. They are both often repeatedly hammered for poor social practice and governance. But really, if you dip under the surface of both of those companies, they support their staff far better, or they support good performance, and they support loyal staff far better than some other companies.
I mean, isn't that what this ultimately boils down to? Business performance. So if putting the S in your business makes it perform better, then that's the right thing to do. Surely the thing to do that any business should do is to employ the right people and put them in the right jobs and treat them in the right way, regardless of whether they're black, white or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. You would think. But obviously that hasn't always happened in the past, which is why there are protests at the moment. But I think in the Western world, things are changing, certainly, but maybe they're not yet there yet. But that's why ESG can be a good thing, because it can help with, it can create positive change in business, because ultimately what these companies are doing is trying to make money. And this is again something that we'll discuss more with James, if companies can see that they'll make more money because they're doing well on ESG metrics, then yeah, maybe they might start being more socially minded, which would be a good thing. Reason shouldn't be just for good ESG scores.
Is getting the good ESG score important now to companies because it gets them included in certain tracker funds? Yeah. So they're basically just doing that to access capital more cheaply. Mm-hmm. Again, is that the right reason or the wrong reason? We've talked about ESG being a label that's being applied willy-nilly, and that the way of measuring it is not that refined just yet. So basically, companies are doing this just so that they're investable.
Yeah, exactly. Which, I mean, I think that's the wrong way. That's the wrong reason to be trying to be more socially minded. Yeah, it also seems to be like the actions that are being taken just for ESG scores or just to say, well, look at what good stuff we're doing. That actually undermines what I think the whole protests are about, which is actually a fundamental change rather than just doing it for the sake of doing it.
I saw a fantastic clip from the historian Neil Oliver, and he was talking about, you've actually got these protests going on which are against slavery that happened in the past. See now is, people actually recording those protests on their mobile phones. And actually some of the raw ingredients that go into a mobile phone, cobalt in particular, are mined in appalling conditions by what essentially amounts to modern day slavery. So again, are we looking in the wrong direction at all of this? And, certainly the mining and oil and gas industry, they're right in the middle of this. I think Philip talks about this later.
Philip makes a really interesting point about this, because I was asking him about why social image matters more to some companies than it does to others. And he makes the point that for some companies, their social image is so bad anyway that really people just accept that mining companies, oil and gas companies, and also to a certain extent the big tech companies are bad. I mean, Facebook, I think, is a really interesting example of a company which its social image is pretty appalling. And last year, Mark Zuckerberg spent a lot of time in front of the Senate trying to answer questions about why personal data was mined by a company that wasn't actually associated with Facebook, but was using Facebook's data, Cambridge Analytica, personal information being dredged out of that tech company. And Facebook's share price rose, I think it was about 30% in the days that Mark Zuckerberg was in front of the Senate. People don't seem to care as much, or it doesn't seem to matter as much to the share price. Investors don't seem to care as much if the company is already has a bit of a bad reputation, which Facebook certainly has.
Mm, absolutely. I remember as well that not too long ago, there were a lot of question marks over Apple's use of Foxconn to manufacture its phones out in China. A lot of employee suicides, I think, was the big problem there. Mm. You know, China's a really interesting example when we talk about, you know, social aspects of investing, because China's not behaving too well at the moment, and yet every single company in the world seems to want to go there because it's such a huge market.
Mm-hmm.
It's fascinating. We're going to be looking at this in a few weeks, I think, but I really struggle with the idea that we are moving towards this amazing ESG world when companies are also looking at China in particular. We've got a big supplement this week and I've written about China. Because China is known for intellectual property theft, it's cracking down on democracy in Hong Kong. It's right in the middle of, you know, accusations of mistreatment of significant portions of its minority populations. I mean, you know, yet companies seem to be able to turn a blind eye to it, and that's all fine.
Yeah, and there's a lot of companies which have prioritised growth in China over everything else, because there is growth on offer in China where there isn't so much in the US and in Europe. And is there going to come a time in the near future, probably, that the ethics of China undermine their investment case there? I mean, if they're looking for growth, then China's going to be the place to be. But then they're going to, yeah, it's going to be harder to spin a good ethical story and a good social story, although I suppose they have been doing it for a while anyway. But yeah, China's a really interesting, it's a fascinating subject from the investment point of view. And we are going to discuss that in a couple of weeks' time. We were going to do it this week, but we've got an exciting interview coming up next week, so we decided to hold off.
I know who it is. Let's quickly turn to governance. Now, you know, we talk a lot about S, but, you know, I have the feeling that in a well-governed company, the E and the S will happen naturally. So, you know, if you run your business well, and you have the right process in place and the right targets, the right objectives and motivations for what you're doing, then the rest of it follows. I mean, lots of focus on the S. Is it not G that matters more?
I think it is. And James, with his data bank, disagrees, as you'll hear later. But from just a anecdotal, common sense, whatever you want to call it, point of view, governance surely is the most important of the three. And surely it's also not even like this ESG thing. ESG, the G is just good investing. It's just investing in companies which are run very, very well. And there are a lot of them out there. They're often, you look for the ones which are founder-led, the ones where the chief executive isn't being paid a ridiculous sum of money, the ones where there's little disparity between the staff salaries and the management salaries, ones that are investing in the right things, good quality metrics, which we talk about a lot, especially at the moment, good cash flow, good management of cash. All of these things, they relate to governance, but they're also just good companies. And if you have got a good company, then yes, it's going to be investing in the right things for the future. And actually, the right things for the future are things with good social practice and good environmental practice, because realistically, we are turning away, however much people feel the need to continue to protest about these things, and it's right that they do, we are moving more into a society which is greener, because we have to. Maybe it's not as quick as people would have liked, it's not as quick as it should have been, but we will get there eventually, and that's why good environmental practice is the right thing to be investing in, as is good social practice.
It reminds me of W.H. Smith, actually, which, I mean, it's obviously going through the ringer at the moment, but that's not a problem of its own making. But I remember over the years, it would, you know, you looked at that high street business and thought, you know, how is that still going? But what it did was a relentless focus on cost saving, you know, trimming the operating costs of its store base. And one way it was doing that was basically by making them much more energy efficient. So long before everyone else was doing it. So, yeah, actually, to run the business well and get the performance out of it that it wanted, it focused on making decisions that would actually make it a more environmentally friendly business as well.
W.H. Smith is I find W.H. Smith a really fascinating one from what it invests in. And yeah, okay, saving money in its lighting made its sort of shops really grey and dingy, but didn't really seem to matter. And its high street business, I mean, it's not doing well, but W.H. Smith apart from the recent difficulties with travel, is actually doing well, and it's come from good management decisions.
Absolutely. Do we hear from Philip now? I've had a listen to your interview already. It's a good one. Let's roll it.
Hi, Philip. Thanks very much for joining us for the podcast again. So this week we're talking about corporate image, which is a topic which is being discussed quite widely at the moment because of what's going on in the wider news with the racial inequality protests which are happening. And while that is a very pressing issue for everyone, there's also a very strong read across into investment and to corporate image, because corporate image really, really matters. And one company that it is particularly pressing for is the US sportswear giant Nike. And yeah, you've got some views on that, of course. So do you want to just sort of paint the general picture of why image matters so much to Nike?
Well, I guess chiefly because it's the ultimate lifestyle company. If you want to think about companies which make their corporate bucks by peddling a lifestyle, then you'll be hard pressed to think of a better example of that than Nike. I mean, after all, what does it do? It makes running shoes, it makes T-shirts, it makes stuff like that. But somehow it's created a company worth $140 billion out of that. If Nike had its prime listing on the London market, it would be the most valuable company in London. And all that is, as I say, based on selling T-shirts. Nike might argue with that, but you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Which does mean that, and the company says it itself, brand is extremely important to it, which is why it tries to back sports stars who are high profile, who are succeeding, and also sports stars who are doing the right thing from a social perspective. And one of those is Colin Kaepernick, the original sports person who took the knee. This was a few years back, but this is obviously something that's become we're far more accustomed to now in the last few weeks, and everyone is taking a knee. But yeah, so Nike backed Colin Kaepernick at the time, and his decision making has almost driven some corporate decisions.
It certainly has. I mean, the best example of that quite recently was that Nike launched a running shoe called the Betsy. It was based on the Betsy Rose flag. And for readers who aren't aware of this, the Betsy Rose flag is an early version of the Stars and Stripes. And it's most obviously associated with American independence. And last year, almost a year ago now, Nike launched this running shoe, calling it the Betsy Rose flag shoe, to coincide with Independence Day. However, to an extent, the Betsy Rose flag also associates with the early American Republic, which was at least in part based on slavery. So there were objections to that, particularly from Colin Kaepernick, and the company very quickly withdrew that shoe. Now, whether that was a good move or not, I'm not sure. They got a certain amount of flak for withdrawing it, but on the other hand, they got a lot of applause from various other communities for doing so. It's a tiger they kind of have to ride all the time. They want to be good, but they've got a pretty wide clientele to be good towards nowadays.
Yeah, absolutely. And it has, I mean, Nike has suffered its fair share of corporate scandals. I mean, most recently, the Oregon Project, and before then, Lance Armstrong. And it's very quick to move away from those negative stories, because it really, really matters to a company like that. And a company where growth, I mean, as you say, its value is astronomical, considering what it does is T-shirts and running shoes. So investors are expecting growth. And that growth is only going to continue to come if its customers really value the brand. So keeping that brand relevant to its customers is extremely important for a company like Nike.
Yeah, sure, absolutely. Any company which came up with the slogan, the slogan "Just Do It," has got to keep on top of ace marketing. You know, it just has to be the slickest marketing operation you could imagine. Which brings challenges with it. It's kind of diversified across a wide range of sports now, so that's kind of good. But it also produces dangers, because if it's diversified across a wide range of sports and a wide range of clients, therefore, customers, therefore, there's always a danger while it's keeping some customers happy, it runs the risk of, building the wrath of other customers.
Yeah, and that's particularly relevant as it ages, as the company ages, as its consumers age. And as Nike diversifies, it needs to keep its core audience in mind and also make sure that audience remains direct. Keeping its customers happy is very important, and that's an issue that's been seen in other companies. Harley Davidson is an example, which got old with its customer base.
It got old with its customer base, which has been good for a while. Presumably, it won't be good forever. Harley responded by making its hogs, or they, if you're into bikes, then you call Harley Davidson bikes hogs, apparently. Okay, so it made its hogs bigger and wider to accommodate rather sort of, rotund Americans, and that revived sales, but it may not revive sales forever. An alternative strategy, of course, is to kind of try and change your image. And, you will see that, think about athletics. We're talking about Nike. Think about athletics. Think about LucasAid, Glaxo's LucasAid product. That was a brilliant example of changing a brand from being old and stodgy and associated with illness and recovering from flu and stuff like that, into being a brand that was associated with athleticism and youth and vigor and so on and so forth. Companies can do these things, can try these things. I guess Nike isn't quite there yet, because it's still got new sports it's still got some sports, I wouldn't say to conquer, but it's still growing in some sports, like football in particular. And it's growing in some markets China's the best example of that. Revenue in China has semi tripled in the last 4 or 5 years. Corporate aging is always a challenge.
And China actually throws up another challenge for companies like Nike and other companies in America, because at the moment there are obviously tensions between the two countries, and companies which aren't being seen to support their home country, support America, are potentially feeling a bit of backlash, especially on the political angle, from the political side. I mean, Donald Trump isn't happy with any company which continues to do business in China, and that's a decision that many companies are going to be facing in the next few months and years. Do they continue to push into this growth market, which is China, at the potential detriment of American business?
Yeah, indeed, it's a tough one. Let me see now. I'm looking at some figures here. Revenue in China has gone from $2.6 billion to $6.2 billion in the last 5 years. Revenue in North America has gone from $13.7 billion to $15.9 billion. Okay, so in China they've added slightly more revenue than they've added in North America. China is catching up, and catching up fairly rapidly. It's a tough one. It's a tough one particularly, while Donald Trump is the president. Donald Trump, incidentally, who had the Betsy Ross flag on his podium when he took his initial presidential inauguration. That might be part of the reason why there was so much controversy when they launched when Nike launched that particular shoe. Sorry, I'm rambling a little bit. But you're absolutely right. Companies have to make choices, and you can imagine that in not too many years' time, China may be almost as important as North America anyway. And by which time, hopefully, North America will have another and perhaps a more sympathetic president. One never knows. That could go either way.
Yeah, absolutely. Who knows with that? Well, one final point just to make just quickly is that obviously we have focused on Nike. It's a fascinating company. But one reason why all this issue is particularly prevalent with Nike and its peers is because it's consumer facing, and we have seen other examples of other companies which have had major controversy. Facebook potentially being a very recent one. I mean, yes, that's a consumer facing company, but it makes money via ads rather than from its consumers, from its actual users. BP and its oil spill, Rio Tinto recently, and mining disasters. these kind of controversies don't seem to matter quite as much to the companies which are not consumer-facing.
Yeah, I'm not sure I'd agree with that re-BP. I mean, BP, you know, that was almost like an existential thing. But with Rio Tinto, very much so. You know, this is a controversy which has arisen in the past month or so. Rio Tinto destroyed a sacred site for, I shouldn't laugh, but there's some bad humor, I suppose, associated with it. Rio Tinto destroyed a sacred site for Aborigines in Australia. And first of all, it had permission to do this, theoretically. And first of all, it kind of said, well, look, you should have objected more. It said to the Aboriginal community, look, you should have objected more. Otherwise, you know, we would have stopped. But now it's kind of backtracked and it's apologizing, and it will have an investigation, and it'll probably pay over money and so on and so forth. But you're right. This has had actually no effect on the share price whatsoever. The share price has risen something like 25%, in the period, that this has been happening. The moral of this, I suppose, is that, you know, a company can only protect the reputation it has, not the reputation that it wants to have. And if you're a miner, then sad but true, you probably don't have a very good reputation anyway, which isn't, that's not a reason to sort of go out and destroy things, but it is a reason why share prices don't get punished very much when companies go and make almighty great mistakes and blow something up that they shouldn't have done.
I know, it's a really interesting point. Well, thanks, Philip. That was a really good, really interesting discussion. Good to speak to you again.
Okay, many thanks.
Well, that's a really great interview, Megan.
Yeah, it was really interesting. It was really good fun. Philip has a wealth of history knowledge, which on everything, even though he's not 100% sure of the, how you say Nike, but he did have a reason for that. And it also comes down to history. It was because he said that when he was at school, he was learning about a goddess whose name is spelt like that. And he was taught that it was said Nike, which is why he now calls the company Nike, Nike. So it all comes down to history for Philip.
I think Philip's going to be writing a lot more for our education section, isn't he, as well?
Yes, hopefully, yeah. Because he knows so much about the origins. And actually, that's really important. And it all comes back down to the social side of stuff as well. That looking back at the origins of things is what people are doing now. And it's very relevant in business too, and investment.
Indeed. I mean, it's interesting, you know, thinking about origins. If you look at the stock market and many of the companies on it, and you know, many of the investment trusts that have been around for, you know, 100 years or so, you know, if we aren't trying to erase this past and the wrongdoings of the past, you wouldn't have much of a stock market left. I mean, where does it end? And should these companies be, you know, apologizing for their past or making reparations for the way that wealth was created? I mean, what should happen? I mean, I just wonder where this ends sometimes.
Yeah, no, it's hard to tell. And I don't know what the right answer is. I'm sure people have lots of opinions on what the right answer to that question is. But surely you would think that as long as companies are investing properly for the future and responsibly for the future, that's the right way to go. And we'll now hear from James, who talks about how investors can do that. Hi, James. Thanks very much for joining us. So ESG is something that you have talked about a lot. We as a magazine talk about it a lot, but you have a particular passion for it at the moment. Do you want to just explain briefly what ESG investing is, and especially in the context of what we're talking about in this podcast, the S is especially interesting.
Hi, Megan. ESG it stands for Environmental, Social and Governance, as everybody knows. And it's really the idea that investors, they want to see their money doing good. And actually, some of the research and the empirical evidence recently is suggesting that does well for your portfolio as well. Responsible investing has been around for, you know, for probably a couple of decades, but it's really taken on added impetus now. On the environmental side, you know, the climate emergency since the Paris Agreement in 2016. Governance has always been with us, but oddly enough, there's the least correlation between index providers on that. And obviously, with what's going on around the world with Black Lives Matter, and, you know, the response of companies to the COVID-19 crisis, the social element is coming more and more into focus at the moment.
Yeah, that social bit is, I mean, it's been particularly relevant in the last few weeks, as you say, with the Black Lives Matter, but yeah, also with how companies are treating their staff during coronavirus. And it's something that many companies are called up for quite regularly. It's interesting that investors now have a way of investing in companies which are being socially responsible, because the funds that run ESG funds try and quantify all three of those points. The social one in particular, for me, I find that it's a really difficult thing to quantify. How do you tell whether a company is being socially responsible?
Well, it is very difficult, and there's several strands to it, of course, and some of them, some companies are good at one thing and poor at another, and that works across the interaction between the three elements of ESG, and it also within different sort of sub elements, if you like, within social. I mean, you might have a wonderful sort of right on branding strategy. So, for example, you know, we talk about Nike and Adidas. They were the first, you know, given the importance of their branding campaigns, as well as Nike was built by Michael Jordan. Although he was famously, as anyone who's seen The Last Dance, he was famously very apolitical and was criticised by members of the black community for that. But black athletes have been hugely important in the growth of these brands. Adidas have got Paul Pogba now, sort of 41 million Instagram followers. And then the way that brands are reaching is through their it's through their athletes' social media profiles. So they have to be on brand. But then on the other flip side of that, well, you know, Nike, Adidas, you know, they've had terrible scandals with sweatshops. Now you've got companies there. If Black Lives Matter so much, is it just Black lives in developed countries where people there's high media presence, social media presence? Or is it people from black and ethnic minority who are actually making these products? So the scoring is difficult, and there's very little uniformity between sort of index providers as well. There's not much. The correlations are quite weak on the social strand, and even weaker on governance, oddly enough, which is funny. But that's possibly you'd expect sort of with accounting rules that to be the same, but because it includes things like board structure, you might have sort of and some things may be counted as social by one provider and governance as another. For example, you know, if you're sort of, you know, women on boards, so there's a lot of disparity there. To get access to ESG, there's different funds which will use different benchmarks as well.
So as well as obviously the funds, the issue that the funds have in bundling their companies into their funds, I mean, whether they're active or passive, in picking the companies that are represented in these ESG funds, they also really rely on the company's self-reporting. I think that's why Nike and Adidas are really interesting examples, because, as you say, are they being socially responsible for the sake of their brand or because they're genuinely socially responsible? And if it is just for the sake of their brand, that arguably means they're not being socially responsible. So investors are maybe piling into these funds thinking that they're doing good, but really it's not. A lot of what some companies are doing, not all companies obviously, are not for altruistic factors. They're because they want to make their brand look healthy, and that's a real issue with ESG, because it is so difficult to quantify, and you are so reliant on companies self-reporting.
Well, this is obviously where asset managers and stewardship comes into it. Interestingly, iShares have launched sort of six new ETFs in the US in the last week, and they've got two which are sort of ESG advanced, where there's a real stronger tilt towards companies that do well. So that's an example of the passive side. On the active side, then you're really looking at, you know, at how your asset manager, what they're doing in terms of voting rights and asserting, you know, what they think a company should do to be responsible. Otherwise, you know, it's very easy. I think you could just look at a benchmark.
So this is a point about why ESG investing can be a positive thing, because it has the potential to create change in corporate. Because if companies are not going to get investment because they are not being socially responsible, they could be more inclined to be socially responsible. So here is where ESG funds, if they are properly managed, if they are properly sold, and I mean the iShares thing, I think they're great, but I mean the timing does seem a bit odd. So they're launching these new funds in a week or in a month where social responsibility has suddenly become much more important. But if they can be managed properly, then they could be an opportunity for real change, which is helped by the investors picking ESG as an investment strategy.
So you've got some interesting developments. So SoftBank, now they've announced their $100 million fund, where they're going to prioritise businesses, and they've used the slightly condescending term led by persons of colour. But it's a great, that's one of the problems is you know, talented black and other ethnic minority entrepreneurs have more difficulty accessing funding. It's one of those insidious aspects of racism that's sort of it's sort of invisible, but it's there, and it's a problem. So this is a good development, but then you know you look at these some of these positive initiatives, and the question of is it woke washing? You know, this is a company which you know, SoftBank has been in the news. It has some funny things that have gone on with its board, and it's interesting to see are these companies jumping on board with a big issue to help sort of distract from other issues that they've sort of other bad press they've had in the last year or so.
Well, yeah, that's very true. But yeah, then it does sort of call into question, I mean, whether or not these fund managers are just slapping ESG stickers on their funds because they do appeal to a wider range of people, when really their focus, their primary focus for investing is ultimately just making more money.
Yeah, I mean, there is a risk of that. But, there are people out there. There's the principles of responsible investing, which is sort of the UN-backed principles, which asset managers are signing up to, big asset managers. So there's pressure from asset owners and different types of asset owners and big asset managers to make sure these things are done. There's a real focus on it. And at the company level, the asset managers have to keep the companies honest for the sake of their investors.
So for you, obviously you looked into it a lot, investing in ESG, if you are, especially at the moment, if you're trying to think about corporate social responsibility, is it a good strategy?
ESG should really be thought of as a framework for assessing sort of operational and financial and governance risks that have always existed for companies. And that's probably a way of looking at it.
That's great. James, that's a good point to end on. Thank you very much for joining us.
Cheers.
Okay, so it is possible to play these themes. Another interesting interview there, Megan. Thank you very much.
Yeah, no, it is. James knows a lot about how to invest in trackers and in indexes and in things, tilts. And that's, I mean, ESG tilts are how a lot of people get access to these things. So it is, yeah, it is possible. It's also worth taking some of what fund managers tell you with a pinch of salt, as we discussed.
I thought you hated the word tilt. What does it mean? It sounds like jargon, Megan.
I don't like the word tilt at all. Tilts are used to give greater exposure to certain aspects of a market. So if you want companies which score very highly on from social perspective, an index is tilted. I'm using inverted commas for that, for to give you greater exposure to the companies which score highly on those metrics. But yes, it is. It's industry jargon. But unfortunately, that happens a lot.
Indeed. Talking of jargon and hating it, let's now hear from Phil Oakley, who I think hates jargon more than anybody. How are you doing, Phil?
I'm hot.
Yes, it is very, very hot indeed. Been in the garden? Topping up the tan?
Kind of. Not much today, but I have been, yeah.
Well, the pubs will be open soon, so you can head down the beer garden. So, Phil, I know that a report from Bank of America has caught your eye this week. Tell us about it.
Yeah, I mean, it's a report that came out yesterday, so Wednesday. We're talking on Thursday, which grabbed a lot of headlines in sections of the financial media, basically saying that Sterling, their view was that Sterling, the pound sterling, should be viewed as an emerging market currency, or almost is emerging market currency, because the fundamentals behind it, and with particular reference to the ongoing trade negotiations with the EU, meant that essentially they saw it as a basket case, and that sterling could fall a lot lower than its current 124 dollars that it currently buys now. I agree with that. I agree with that, but not for the reasons that they're saying.
Talk us through their reasons and why you disagree with them, and what you think will weaken the pound instead.
Okay. I mean, I've not read the report. I've only seen reports of the report, mainly looking at the Financial Times, that's gone into it in quite a lot of detail. It's essentially all about Brexit, and it's all about how, you know, the uncertainty over getting a trade deal for next year to start on the 1st of January next year, and the risk that we don't get one and we go and trade on World Trade Organization terms means that sterling will go to hell in a handcart. That's essentially how I understand what this report is saying.
That doesn't feel like a particularly new view, though. I mean, people were predicting the demise of sterling all throughout the Brexit process.
Yeah, I mean, it's not. And I don't want to get involved in this toxic subject. But all I will say is this: is that let's not count anything out in or count anything out yet. I think it's far too early to say that no trade deal will be done. But my view on sterling, I think you can park this to one side, because what I think that happens throughout history is that you get events which expose a situation for everyone to see. Some might argue that Brexit was that. I think the coronavirus is definitely that. And Britain has been, you know, the value of sterling, the fundamentals that have been underpinning sterling have been weakening since the Second World War. And this is part of a long trend of decline in the economic clout of the UK. And we had a brief sort of respite sort of from the nadir in, 1985, where I think sterling traded at parity with the dollar at lunchtime on a particular day in 1985, and then I think closed at 105, and then it's gone back up to over $2, and it's moved around a lot, and we're currently now at sort of 124. But the reasons for this is that the fundamentals of the UK economy are not particularly strong. And what's been going on for the last so many decades is an attempt to paper over the cracks. And certain events just bring this to light. And I think that the current situation that we're in, with the lockdown, with the virus, has put everything in very, very stark detail in terms of, you know, the focus of, you know, what difficulties we face as an economy.
So where do you think the most pressing concerns are when it comes to the fundamentals of the UK economy?
In a nutshell, I don't think there's enough wealth generating capacity to pay for all the promises that we've made as a country, particularly on areas like welfare. And essentially, the claims upon the economic output of the country have been getting bigger and bigger. And we have a system which is essentially eating itself. So we have more, you know, we have aging population, we have weak economy, we have weak productivity growth, weak wage growth, and we cannot produce enough wealth and enough tax revenue to pay for all these nice things that that governments have promised the population since 1945.
What? Why is that? I mean, we have the city, which has been very successful on the global stage. Why do we not have the wealth-producing capability elsewhere in the economy? What's gone wrong?
Well, it's a long history, but it lost competitiveness after the war. There was a lack of investment. There was a problem with the trade unions. And we've just seen a continued shift away from a quite productive, relatively speaking, manufacturing, value-added economy to a service sector which doesn't seem to create the same amount of wealth. You know, in very, very simple terms, you used to have a lot of very well-paid or reasonably well-paid blue-collar jobs. And a lot of those have been out. And this is a problem for the West as a whole, but Britain, I think, is probably right in the mire with this, in that you go from producing stuff, tangible stuff, which employs a significant amount of people on reasonable wages, which means they can buy stuff and their standard of living increases. And you replace it with increasingly low wage service economy jobs that don't allow people to do that. And you then try and plug the gap with debt and with property.
Yeah, so you've got a lot of borrowing to buy things like cars or to buy clothes or trainers on credit, none of which are produced in this country. Well, very few of which are produced in this country.
I mean, no one talks about the trade deficit anymore. You know, it used to be seen as a big problem. And, you know, if you had like a twin deficit, so the British economy is now running a twin deficit, you know, in terms of a budget deficit on the government and up until recently, you know, a trade deficit. It's been sucking in imported goods. And so in both cases, it is reliant on the kindness of strangers, of essentially foreigners, to put money into Britain to borrow, to balance the books. And essentially that props up sterling, or the value of the pound in the short term. And I think what's happening now with the coronavirus, and we see it in things like, you know, the hospitality sector, bars, hotels, leisure industry, big employers of people, but actually not paying huge amounts of wages.
And also not very profitable in themselves anyway. I mean, it's a sector which is, you know, ripe with very, very low margin, low quality businesses.
Yeah.
That, as we've seen, are totally unable to cope with a downturn, and especially a severe downturn when it comes.
Yeah. And, you know, I thought it was another interesting comment, you know, on the Bank of America, in addition to the Bank of America thing, was the attention that was drawn to a comment by Andrew Bailey, the new governor of the Bank of England, who was very, very matter of fact about pretty much saying that the government was almost bust a few weeks ago. And, you know, I've had conversations with people who are still in, you know, the money management industry, talking about the ability to trade gilts at prevailing prices quoted on screens was very, very difficult until the Bank of England intervened. And, you know, I think things, you know, I don't like to talk like this, but I think there's a lot to worry about in terms of the UK's ability to get out of this, because where it was before was so fragile.
So basically, you know, we're not talking about something that is entirely the outcome of coronavirus, but coronavirus has essentially shown us where those weaknesses are. It's brought them to a head.
It's like going into a new house and lifting up the carpets and finding that half the floorboards have disappeared.
Yeah, it's. I mean, it's a slightly terrifying situation. I mean, you mentioned earlier, it's funny, because the rest of this podcast, we're talking about kind of the S in ESG, the social aspect of investing. And we've been talking about some of the sort of protest movements that have been taking place around the world. And, you know, I know we're going to avoid that subject, but when we talk about welfareism and what's happening in this country, these sound like, you know, big social problems.
Oh, yes, they are, because everybody wants money.
Yeah, but of course they do. But the old-fashioned way of getting money was to go out and work for it. Now, you know, what are we talking about here? That people don't want to work, or that the work that is there for them to do just doesn't pay them enough? Is this a structural problem in terms of the nature of pay in industry? Is it a management, a governance problem? I mean, you know, where do you look to start solving this? You talked about demographics.
Yeah. I think a lot of what you said is right. People do want to work. People want to get on. I don't believe that we, you know, almost in sort of tabloid journalism style, that we are a nation of lazy people who just want to sit and do nothing and have people pay for us. I don't believe that for one second.
No, nor do I.
People want to work, and it's not just working for money. They want a sense of purpose in life, which is a very important aspect of working. And there is a problem that has been brewing for the last 50 years, certainly in America, but maybe for the last 40 years, 30, 40 years in this country. And we've touched on it in previous podcasts. And what we are seeing, or what we have seen, is the growth in the power of business over labour. And, you know, there is very little organised labour now. The workers have very little power to exercise. If you look at the continued dominance of big companies in lots of sectors and lots of ways of our, you know, day-to-day life, these companies are becoming more powerful. There are becoming fewer of them. So power is being concentrated, which means there are fewer buyers of labour, which means that the worker can't trade as many companies off against each other. And so getting a pay rise for a lot of people is quite hard. And I think, but I think also the ability of the UK economy to create these kind of jobs is not there. We have got some sections of the economy. I'm talking about, you know, places like Cambridge, where there's some fantastic technology businesses. We've got, you know, some very good niche engineering businesses. We've still got an aerospace business. We've got pharmaceuticals. We've got some petrochemicals. We've got the city. But they're not massive employers of people. And there's a huge sort of, you know, if you imagine like the sort of classic bell curve of a distribution of people, you've got this big fat middle, yeah, where a lot of people are really struggling to make themselves better off. And that's the same in a lot of the Western world. At the same time, you've got governments who are borrowing money to pay for things like pensions, for health services. And now they've got something like the coronavirus. Where are they going to pay for this? You know, they can't, you know, they can keep borrowing, or they can print up money, or they can get the central banks to print up money, or they can put up taxes, or they can cut public spending.
You would imagine we're in for some pretty chunky tax increases, particularly amongst the sort of the higher earners in society.
I think you're going to see things like wealth taxes come onto the table, because you struggle to see how you can tax income more than you have done.
But then, Phil, you know, we talk about the problem this country has is that there is simply not enough wealth creation. And so let's slap a tax on wealth creation. And you know, surely this is the exact opposite of what we should be doing to get out of the hole that has been dug in the long term. It might be a short-term fix, but it does not solve the problem.
Absolutely right, yeah. And, you know, we have a very narrow tax base. You know, it's often said, you know, that 27% of the tax is being paid by the top 1%. And, you know, these people quite rightly will probably think that they're paying their fair share. So Sterling in my view deserves to be weak, and it's taken an event to say, you know, the emperor has no clothes. And you hope that there is somebody out there, or, you know, somebody in the government, I think probably, or sufficient entrepreneurs out there that can be helped by the government, if they need to be, to try and get us out of this. You know, there's a lot of talk. You know, I remain very bullish on, you know, the potential for things like green energy in this country. How you could create a lot of jobs, you could drive down the cost of energy.
Essentially, build an industry around something that will be a relevant technology for the future.
Yes,
invest in it heavily, whatever it takes, but to create an industry upon which future wealth can be built.
Yeah, so don't print money to prop up the stock market. You know, I don't want them to print money at all. But if you're gonna throw money at something, don't throw it at the stock market. Throw it into productive capacity, and things like green energy, so more wind power, you know, things like wave power. I mean, I'm sure, you know, there are people who know a lot more about this than, you know, me.
We've written about this in the magazine, the New Future series that we're running. We've looked at energy, and, you know, there's other areas, hydrogen, battery storage, you know, energy storage, that sort of thing. There's a lot of it.
But you go back to energy, and energy is so important. You know, if you have cheap energy, and you can create a whole thesis on the fact that a lot of prosperity has been created off the back of cheap and secure energy. But you look at a lot of countries like France did after the oil crisis of the 1970s. You know, they invested in nuclear energy and had the cheapest electricity in Europe. How much good it's done them, I don't know, but they're probably better off than what they were before. But I think, you know, the bottom line is, you know, how low will Sterling go? And I have a sort of very old colleague friend, you know, from my days in the city, and we talk every week. And both him and I don't think it's out of the question that you could have parity with the dollar. You know, because of the people talk about the weakness of the dollar because they are, you know, creating lots of dollars, but currencies are relative. And, you know, I would much rather have my investments in dollars than investments in pounds. And yes, there are a few good companies, but I think for investors, this is really important. And, you know, it's about trying to invest in good companies with lots of overseas earnings, and also protect yourself by investing in American shares or good global shares. And that can be done really cheaply now through lots of, you know, you could buy, you know, a simple S&P 500 ETF, but the ability now to invest in even sections of the American stock market, and we talked about this a few weeks ago, it's there, it's cheap, it's liquid, it's easy to trade. And, you know, if you subscribe to the view that Sterling is going lower, it's something that can protect the value of your investments.
Indeed. We've actually, this week in the magazine and on the website, we've published our platform guide for buying overseas shares. Because it's not, there are some complications that you don't necessarily have when buying UK shares. I mean, I've often heard investors suggesting that the currency risk of buying over shares is too much for them, so they tend to avoid it. But actually, the currency risk of not buying them now seems to be the thing we should perhaps be more worried about. And, you know, we ran a feature recently called The World's Best Shares. And you know what? It's one of the best-selling features, best read things we've written in ages. I think people are waking up to this, Phil. And actually, next week's podcast is all about America.
Yeah.
So we can talk more about this then. Thank you very much, Phil. So a bit of a gloomy one today, despite the lovely weather, but we'll be back with some positive solutions next week in America.
Thanks, John.
Cheers, Phil. And that, I'm afraid, is all we have time for this week, but there is lots more in the magazine and on the website, as ever. I've already mentioned Mary McDougall's article on the best platforms for overseas shares. And sticking to the international theme, we are looking at a paper that makes the case for buying US small caps in our new education section. There's stacks of stuff in the magazine this week on cash flow, which I suspect is going to come into focus as the nation starts to claw its way back from COVID-19. Philip Ryland explains how to understand how cash flow is reported, and Algy Hall uses it as the basis of his stock screen this week. But the main feature, survival of the fittest, is looking at what we can expect on the M&A front in the post-COVID landscape, and who might profit from a wave of corporate Darwinism that sees the strong get stronger. Thank you, Philip, James and Phil, for your insights this week, and of course, my co-host Megan. And thank you all for listening. Enjoy the weekend, and we'll be back again next week when we'll be discussing investing in the US. Take care.